Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report on lockdown. And I can see in the chat that people are already saying, Damage Report starting on time. What is this? Hey, we've been pretty good about being on time considering. Do you know what we're dealing with here? But anyway, thank you to everybody who's already here. Everybody in the chat, but also J.R. Jackson. J.R., it's not Wednesday. What the hell are you doing here?
You know what? It doesn't matter what day it is anymore, does it? Is today Saturday or is today Monday? They all feel the same.
What's the difference? I don't know. I make less videos on the weekends, so I guess that's something. By the way, I saw Dan from the internets in the chat.
Oh, really?
Who just typed out my corona, which seems inappropriate, but you caused this by implying that our theme song is like My Sharona.
The problem is that whoever chose the theme song did it because it's the same song.
Okay, so that person is me, and that is not why I picked it. I picked it because it roughly went to that animation thingy. Anyway, JR, thank you for being here. You know, normally JR is on Wednesdays. I think tomorrow it's actually going to be Emma. They've done a little switcheroo because Emma is also on lockdown and is, you know, very busy, obviously.
Emma and I had an agreement to toss up your show and make it as crazy as possible in 1 week.
It's insane, but I think I can adapt. And so everybody who's already here in the chat, thank you so much. There's already almost 1,000 of you here. Amanda, hello to you too. And so if everyone here could get us started with some likes to help send this stream out to other people. Turns out that the algorithm is just constantly thirsty for likes. So let's provide it that which it craves. So if you could do that, that would be great. Feel free to share it and all of that. Through the course of the hour, we've got a number of topics that we're going to be talking about. We're going to be starting off with the absolutely insane, incomprehensible news about Wisconsin, which is voting right now in a pandemic. Seems like a bad idea. We're gonna give you an idea of what the lines are like there. The lines of people who are potentially going to become exposed to coronavirus. So that's always fun. And Donald Trump and hydroxychloroquine. We've been wondering if there was some sort of financial reason that he's been promoting this so heavily. Turns out, what do you know? There is. And
that's nothing like his personality, though.
What's that?
That's nothing like anything he would do, though. It's totally out of his personality.
He's a selfless servant of the people. We've got some other selfless servants of the people, those who profited in the stock market when they were getting confidential information. We've got some updates on that, including a little bit of justice, perhaps, although it's still kind of dark. Stephanie Grisham is out. And also, we've got a racist doctor attacking a girl because she isn't keeping her distance. Makes sense for some reason. But anyway, we've got a lot that we're going to get to. So why don't we launch into the first story, JR? It seemed like as of yesterday, Wisconsin would not be going ahead with in-person voting today. And yet, as you probably are aware, they're voting in Wisconsin, in person, in a pandemic. They're on lockdown. They're told not to get near to each other. Businesses shut down, people furloughed from their jobs, and yet we're going to pack the streets with tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands or millions of people, because the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the Supreme Court seem to think that it was a good idea. Because in America, you can now have a situation where the political action of one party allows them to potentially kill the members of the other party. Now, if that seems like I'm going overboard, let's get into it a little bit. So yesterday, the governor, a Democrat, delayed the election until June, as many other states have, as activists have been pushing for them to for some time. But unfortunately, Republicans didn't like that, so they appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled 4-2 along ideological lines that Governor Tony Evers, a Democrat, could not use emergency powers to unilaterally change the date of the election, which he sought to do to circumvent Republican opposition to the move. Now, bear in mind, he didn't want to do this through executive action. He wanted legislation that would slow it down, but Republicans refused to, because why are they going to get off their asses and pass a bill that would serve to protect the lives of Democrats? They have no interest in that. And so they went to the Supreme Court. And JR, we've got a lot more details and obviously reactions, but the Republicans have now forced the Democrats to have their primary today. And I know that technically there are other elections too, but 99% of the point of all of this is a Democrat primary that will result in Democrats getting sick and Democrats dying. That's what Republicans in the state legislature and the state Supreme Court have now given us.
I think I've been trying to avoid the thought of this being the end game here, because ever since this has gone, and I was like, you know, as you mentioned, the major part of this is the primary election for Democrats. So if Republicans who control the legislature and also this Republican-controlled Supreme Court of the state decides to go this route, I'm like, what is their end game? Because it's not like it benefits them. It's not like it's a general election where, of course, Republicans don't want Democratic voters to come out because, of course, strong voting numbers is a detriment to the Republican Party. They need fewer people voting so they can win because they don't represent the majority of the countries. But that's been admitted. So I was like, what's the end game here if they're looking to disrupt, you know, in other states, Trump would have a rally on the day of an election to disrupt what's going on. So those are disruptions. This is looking to have them continue to do it. But with what reason? And I couldn't allow myself to believe that it was, hey, you know what? Majority of Democratic voters are coming out. So let's go ahead and allow that to happen because who cares if they get sick? And in fact, good thing if they do. I'm still not there yet, but I can't figure out what else it could be.
Well, we have a couple of other ideas. I personally believe that, I mean, look, it's impolite of me to point out that Republicans who have, since this has been a country, as well as sometimes Democrats, have worked to limit voting as much as possible, that they would ever do something that would result in a situation where people were too scared to come out and vote, and theoretically that it would kill some of them. I mean, as I said in the intro, how often do you get to pass a piece of legislation that has the result of killing the opposition party? Right. But that is going to be the effect. We can quibble over whether that's the intent, but that is the effect. And let's bear in mind, we are being very fair here on the damage report. How much did we attack Joe Biden, Tom Perez, and all the rest for pushing forward with elections that would kill their own people? I checked my Twitter. I was very critical of them. And now the Republicans are doing it, messing in a situation that has virtually nothing to do with them. Now, that's not to say it doesn't have anything to do with them. We will get to that. But I do want to just go to reactions from two individuals. I want to contrast these reactions. So the first from Bernie Sanders, who says, it's outrageous that the Republican legislative leaders and the conservative majority in the Supreme Court in Wisconsin are willing to risk the health and safety of many thousands of Wisconsin voters tomorrow for their own political game. That is a great response. And Bernie Sanders goes on to say that he is not going to be advertising and all of that and trying to get people out to vote, even though, let's bear in mind, that is going to hurt him. And I believe that Joe Biden is roughly doing the same thing. So fair is fair. The other reaction is from Tom Perez, who says, our country is in the middle of a public health emergency, but you wouldn't know it by the way the Republican Party in Wisconsin and across the country is acting. And it's part of a DNC statement that is perfectly fine as long as you just woke up from some sort of coma.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tom Perez. It is really irresponsible of them to push for us to vote, which you were just doing in the last set of elections. So I'm glad that you are now aboard the let's not kill our voters train, but you were boop, boop, you were like going ahead with that in the very, like just 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention. It seems like, at least if, again, I'm still looking for the end game here from these Republicans that are controlling these things, they have cover. You know, there's a level of cover that's been provided from the words of Joe Biden to Tom Perez over allowing these things to happen. When Bernie Sanders came out and said, hey, we're worried about the health and safety of citizens and voters, and let's make sure this goes off without a hitch, with the right way later, then I don't know if they want to continue to drive a wedge between the two factions of the party. But again, that being the reason to risk people's lives, I still don't see it as a good enough reason.
Yeah, it's... I saw Gabby in the chat said someone should invade America to spread democracy. And I think that we could use some of that. We could have used that even before this. But I mean, like, as I'm watching these primaries go by and the continued voting in many of them, I just have to wonder, like, what are we setting ourselves up for in the general election? Like, I don't think anyone really knows. There's a lot of theories, obviously a lot of speculation, but I don't think anyone actually knows. It's one thing for the Republican state legislature in Wisconsin to team up with the Republican-led Supreme Court of Wisconsin. That's bad enough. But it wasn't just them. You also had the Supreme Court nationally getting involved in this in a separate decision that also served to make sure that more people would end up getting sick. So, separately, in another blow to Wisconsin Democrats, the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative-leaning majority ruled against their attempt to extend the deadline for absentee voting in Tuesday's elections. In a 5-4 vote, the majority said that such a change fundamentally alters the nature of the election. The court's 4 liberal members dissented, with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg writing that the court's order, I fear, will result in massive disenfranchising of many individuals. So, that by itself doesn't necessarily force more people to go out there and vote, but it will have the side effect of doing that for a reason that I want to get into. So the state so far has received a crush of absentee ballot requests, about 1.2 million, when it typically receives less than 250,000 in a spring election. Tens of thousands of voters are not expected to even receive their ballots until after Election Day, effectively disenfranchising them through no fault of their own. So that means that if you were one of those people that have requested one of these ballots, you would have had extra time until the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, you're going to have to put it out right now. Ruth Bader Ginsburg says, tens of thousands of voters who timely requested ballots are unlikely to receive them by April 7th, the court's postmarked deadline. So before, you were going to have an extended period of time to get it and to send it in. And because so many people are requesting it, many of them aren't even going to get it before they were already supposed to have postmarked it, which means they don't get to vote. Or they have to rush, assuming they're able to, they have to rush to state in lines and potentially expose themselves to coronavirus. So yeah. Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
It's crazy. You know, accountability and explanation needs to come more for adults that are in charge of running states and the federal government in our country. I don't understand it. Every time I see grown folks who we've elected and put in places or been appointed to positions that are important to the well-being and progress of the nation, they continue to just do things that fly in the face of reality and normalcy and common sense, and then no one asks them. So when this problem is presented and says, hey, you know, the postmark date is April 7th, and many people can't even get it by no fault of their own, I assume the question must be asked. I'm looking for the answer. So when these folks are asked, hey, what's your response to this obvious disenfranchisement of voters? Where's that answer? I need to have that question asked. I need it answered. Or they can just ignore it like they do many other things they do that disenfranchises people, that violates people's voting rights. It happens all the time. And anytime someone wants to do something about it, we reel back those protections for the Voting Rights Act and say, we don't need to do that anymore because it's already been taken care of. That whole thing back in the civil rights era, it's done now. We're good. Mm-hmm. Where's the real explanation as to why right now in 2020, we've got a state that's going to run this election and then not give people the chance to vote in it? And then not give an explanation as to why they're okay with that.
Yeah, and it seems sort of crazy that it's 2020. Like, we imagined that we would be 15 years into flying cars at this point, but it's still basically impossible in large parts of the country for large quantities of Americans to vote and to vote safely. We can't come up with anything to allow them to do that. And voice chat apps still are terrible. Like, why is it that by 2020 we haven't fixed these two fairly fundamental things? Yeah. But by the way, JR, you were wondering about what the possible reason for this could be. And I know that a lot of people are going to hear me saying that Republicans actively want to kill voters of the other party and say, well, that's probably a little bit too far. Okay, maybe it is. And here's another potential explanation. So this was a tweet from Donald Trump who said, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that tomorrow's election will proceed as scheduled. Vote for Justice Daniel Kelly tomorrow and be safe. So that is a current Supreme Court justice in Wisconsin. Who's going up for re-election for the first time after being appointed and is facing a challenge from more liberal Jill Karofsky in a nonpartisan general election. So, like I said in the very beginning, it is not just the Democratic primary that's going forward. There are other elections, but for the most part, who cares about any of those? But they do seem to care about this one, about maintaining their majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And it is possible that they think that having this re-election in a time when as few people as possible will vote will give them the maximum chance of holding on to that seat. And so what if maybe a few hundred, a few thousand people get exposed to coronavirus? And so what if dozens or hundreds might die as a result of that? They care about power. That has been abundantly clear, particularly in the Trump era, about pursuing it, acquiring it, and then doing whatever you need to, up to and including killing those who oppose you, to make sure that you hold on to that power.
Yeah, we'll have to look into whatever else Trump may have tweeted about other folks that should be voted for, that he's advocating, that he's backing, is endorsing for this election in Wisconsin, all around the board, just to see if it has more to do with just this particular this appointment or this judge position, because as we know, you know, Mitch McConnell was pointed out from back this near end of the term of Obama's second term, the whole idea, the whole point is to hold off and pack as many courts as possible throughout the country with obedient justices that have nothing to do with following the law, but just following what the Republican Party and specifically Trump's Republican Party wants to do. And this is one of those instances. They had enough of them in this for this decision. They had enough of them in the Supreme Court for that next decision. This is going just as planned. So when you're trying to take over the people that are looking to be that are looking to gain as much power and utilize it to their advantage as much as possible, they don't care about people's lives. Why would they care about that? They haven't cared about it in any other normal situation. Why would they care about it when it's taking care of itself? They're yeah. sitting back and enjoying it as long as they get a chance to continue to take advantage of it. This is just even from capitalism point of range, when we're trying to get people back to work as soon as possible, and oh my God, these huge corporations are hurting, to even the election process. They don't care. It doesn't really matter to them.
They don't. And, you know, not long ago, I interviewed Tom Hartman, and we talked about why Democrats don't put a price in any way on the Republicans, and it's not just Republicans, but when it's like 90% of one party and 10% the other, I don't want to have to keep giving goddamn caveats, on them being so vigorously, viciously opposed to democracy in America, and their fans liking it, honestly, that their voters don't want more people to vote, but independents, perhaps, or people who are not strongly affiliated with the party might be bothered by the fact that one of the two parties is actively engaged in a war with American democracy, but the Democrats barely talk about it. There is no cost to it. Republicans can go around stripping people of the right to vote all over the country, and they don't really suffer in any way as a result of that. And now, like, that was before them doing that would potentially lead to people dying. So yeah. Now it's even worse. I feel like people should start to take this seriously.
Which people? We're talking about, like,
elected citizens? Democrats, the Democratic leadership. Like, I think that if you are going to be in Democratic leadership, you should maybe once a year, lead on something that matters.
Well, they're too afraid to, because then these are hot button issues. These are touchy subjects. These are things that if you say the wrong thing at the wrong time, especially from a position of influence and power, you might come off badly. Citizens might turn on you. It could ruin your election. We're going to talk about Georgia soon and how that's ruining someone else's election, at least at this point. So the fear that's based in saying something that you don't know how it's going to go over is overwhelming to Democrats. So yeah. They're worried so much. They're like, yeah, Republicans are setting fire to everything. And they've always done that. Everyone's used to it. So they get away with it. We're the slow walker, mealy mouth folks that don't do anything.
Yeah.
So once you don't do anything, no one expects you to do it. And you can just sit back and continue to hope things get better. It's just not going to happen that way.
No, it's not gonna...
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Wisconsin is voting, which means Wisconsinites who want to exercise their democratic rights probably are rightfully terrified of what effect it's going to have on their health to do so, but feel like they live in a democracy, so they should be able to vote, are being put into the position where they have to go out and violate social distancing rules to do so. And so they're out there, and I want to give you an idea of what that looks like. So people have been uploading videos. You're seeing one here of people, and they're doing what they can. They're wearing masks, and they're spreading out. But still, like, that's still far more contact than you want to have. And we have, you can see this video here. Those people are far less spread out. Like, they, it looks like they're trying to space them a bit, but with the cones, I guess. But,
you know, I hate to be the cones don't extend as far as the line goes, of course. Because as we've seen, I was at CVS a week or two ago and in line for a prescription, and there was these markers, right? on the floor with tape lines and adding distance and everything. And there was a lot of these precautions put in place. And people don't always follow those things. And then, you know, if someone says, hey, can you please check the line? See, there's a blue line right there. Can you step to that next section? People aren't going to like that either. There's been confrontations. There's been arguments. There's been disruptions. There's been people that we had stories of guys that were arrested for saying they had it and sneezing on someone at like a pharmacy location because the worker said, hey, could you step back, please, sir? And he didn't like that because he felt it was rude. So those things are going to happen. It's human interactions, especially when everyone is on edge, upset. I guarantee you a large majority of people don't want to be there right then.
Oh, totally.
So, yeah, so a lot of tension and a lot of energies are going to be – negative energy is going to be exchanged. And I don't want to predict it, but it's not going to end well in other ways either.
Yeah, like if you still somehow have faith in humanity, just try to get humans to line up for something. It's impossible. You can't do it. You can get to the moon. You can't get humans to line up. And especially when, like, those spacers, which I've been to the supermarket, they have those spacers. There's, you know, 8 of them, and there's 50 people in line. So you do the math on that, and the math comes up with you having coronavirus. So I want to show one more of these videos. So we've got this showing how long this line is.
Well, they have the cones all the way through this one. At least they thought, oh, they didn't picture it to the parking lot. They pictured only to the sides of the building. Which, again,
it's still going.
Bro, it's not even the poll workers' fault. Whoever organized this, what are they supposed to do? You know,
exactly.
Just in case people are wondering, if we're getting on the poll workers for not putting the spacers out correctly or crowd control appropriately enough,
yeah,
what are they supposed to do? Like, this line got formed around two different blocks. However that got formed, who knows? Maybe the voters in line said, hey, you know, I guess we'll wrap this way now.
Maybe. Because the cones don't go that far. Yeah, people are, and they're spacing as much as they can. To give you an idea of how long that line is, I'm in it. Like, it stretches here. And so, like, I feel so bad for them because I got to vote. And you know what I did to vote? I walked into the place that I voted. And yeah, there were some concerns about coronavirus, but it wasn't nearly as common as it is now. I had the ability, the privilege, to be able to vote and be relatively sure that it wasn't going to kill me. Is it so much to ask that in the most advanced, wealthy democracy in the history of our planet, that everyone should get that right? That we could come up with a situation. And we could, by the way. The Supreme Court came in and stopped it. We had the delay that potentially would have gotten us to the point where less people would have had the virus.
Well,
and then they stepped in.
I need answers. They need to give me an official statement. And I demand it. They're going to give it to me because I'm the one who demanded it.
Yeah, they will. And by the way, you should know that one of the reasons the lines are going to be as bad as they are is that there are far less places to actually vote. And no, this is not like in a lot of recent elections where the Republicans just came in and shut down a bunch of polling places, generally in areas where rich white people don't live. That's probably happening too. But what's happening here is in Milwaukee, I'm reading that there were 5 open out of 180 due to a worker shortage. Because what do you know? People are terrified of interacting with literally hundreds or thousands of people during a goddamn pandemic.
We've said
so they didn't show up, understandably.
Yeah, my mother's one of them too. Poll workers generally are older folks, and it's a generalization, but from what I've seen, their majority of them tend to be older folks in my experiences. My mother was one of them. She's a group of that elderly community at this point in her life. So do you think they want to be exposed to it after all we've been hearing about how it affects? And then they said the older you are, many times you have more issues with it. Do you think they want to be out there sitting there and taking every person that comes by them and exchanging any kind of, I don't know, paper, information, conversation, any of that with them? They're not going to be there. And also, a large majority of voters won't be there either. And I'm not out here telling people not to go vote, but it's people's normal thought process. If we've been on quarantine and self-quarantine and stay-at-home suggestions, why would people leave the house and do this?
Yeah, it'd be super confusing, especially when they probably saw the news yesterday that they weren't going to. And then late at night finds out that they have to. It's just a mess. And it doesn't need to be. It's a primary. It can wait. So we've been wondering, what is behind Trump's obsession with hydroxychloroquine? Is it just a distraction? Is he actually obsessed with it for some reason? Or is there a financial incentive behind it? Francesca Fiorentini, who was on the show yesterday, believes it was that. And turns out maybe there was something to that, according to the New York Times. So if hydroxychloroquine becomes an accepted treatment for COVID-19, several pharmaceutical companies stand to profit, including shareholders and senior executives with connections to the president. Mr. Trump himself has a small personal financial interest in Sanofi, the French drug maker that makes Plaquenil, the brand name version of hydroxychloroquine. As of last year, Mr. Trump reported that his three family trusts each had investments in a Dodge & Cox mutual fund, whose largest holding was Sanofi. So that is just the beginning of the connections to Trump and Trump's inner circle, other people in the administration. But what do you know? A few days of digging, and it turns out that, yes, he potentially does stand to profit from people going hydroxy crazy.
There's the transparency of this guy on accident, by the way. This isn't planned transparency. Like he says he was going to be the transparency of everything he does based in self worth, based in his financial statements, especially since things are hurting with his resorts and his hotels and all that stuff because of the natural cause of this. No one's going to look at this and jaw is going to drop. They're going to go, oh, I should have thought of that, unless they already did, which I'm sure many of us considered this in the first place.
Yeah.
This is how things work. This is when they're talking about how socialism is going to ruin the country, but this is capitalism. So you do things, capitalism is so important to you, that you do things that that aren't beneficial to the citizens of the country based off of your bottom line. That's how it always works. And it's consistent competition to be the biggest a-hole, to be the person who screws over the country the most for their bottom line. Or if you don't, you're not a real American. So we've wavered away from any care for the citizens or any real thought process to how to use these things. Again, there's many conservatives online, pundits that are saying, hey, everybody who's against hydroxychloroquine just want more people to die.
Yeah.
What they want is for this to be tested fully so we can find out what it is. It's this scientific process that goes to before you put things in people's bodies on a broad national scale.
Yeah, and by the way, we're getting what we want. That is actually what's going on behind the scenes. What I want is for Trump to not like freak people out, give them false hope, and arm them with something that will cause them to ignore the medical advice of experts by this guy who understands less about science than literally any child you've met, talking about this drug and making money. So we had a little bit of corruption. You want some more corruption? Because we've got more of it. Now, I want you to bear in mind that Sanofi says, according to Ashley Koss, spokeswoman, that the company no longer sells or distributes that name brand version in the U.S., although it does sell it around the globe. And I'm sure that if it starts getting used for this massively, they won't start selling it in the U.S. again. Yeah. So bear that in mind. Also, I would run a fact check on that in the first place. But and it's international. It's going to come back here. Anyway, let's talk about some of the other connections here, because it runs deep. Sanofi's largest shareholders include Fisher Asset Management, the investment company run by Ken Fisher, a major donor to Republicans, including to Mr. Trump. A spokesman for Mr. Fisher declined to comment. Probably a wise choice. Another investor in both Sanofi and Mylan, another pharmaceutical firm, is Invesco, the fund previously run by Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary. Mr. Ross said in a statement Monday that he was, quote, not aware that Invesco has any investments in companies producing the drug, quote, nor do I have any involvement in the decision to explore this as a treatment. My, there's been a lot of activity in D.C. recently involving stocks that they have no ideas going on. I'm not interested in that stuff. It's too technical. Yeah.
They're all multimillionaires just by accident. They have no input. They have no idea. They're clueless as to how the financial markets work. They have no idea how business works. They have no idea how investments work. They have no idea how their money got here. Oh, it's a blind trust. Oh, that bank account is run by my 12-year-old niece. No, it's not. No, it's not. Rich people don't accidentally become rich. They don't accidentally have hordes of money. They don't accidentally put money in places that makes them tons of more money and take it out of other places they would have lost. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen that way, because when rich people do make that mistake of losing money, rich people kill themselves. We've seen it happen. That's all that they care about. It happens. So when you keep talking about how you have no interest and no idea of what happened to the company that had shares in this group that you've never heard of before, it's a blatant lie. I don't care what you have to say. If they can call other folks that want more than $1,200 in a one-time thing in the middle of all this lazy and incompetent and begging for more, we can't say that about folks like this who have tons of things but have moved money around to hurt others more. Let's get it straight. This hurts other people. This isn't just a backdoor deal where you have an advantage with normal things when you're trading on the stock market with insider information. Not that this is what's happening here, but they're influencing the policy based off of their bottom line. It's a similar approach.
Yeah. So let's hear a little bit more about this bottom line, because for
some reason that annoyed me more than others.
This should outrage everyone, but I'm glad that at least we're getting the information. So how deep does it go? Well, it goes even deeper. One of the largest manufacturers of the drug, Novartis, previously paid Trump's now incarcerated former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, more than $1 million for healthcare policy insight following Trump's election in 2016. So now, the unfortunate thing is the only person who hypothetically could get in trouble for us finding that out now is one of the only people that got in trouble already and is now in jail, because nothing's going to happen to the investor, nothing's going to happen to Trump, but Michael Cohen's already serving time. But additionally, several generic drug makers are gearing up to produce the drug, including Amneal Pharmaceuticals, whose co-founder, Chirag Patel, is a member of Trump National Golf Course Bedminster in New Jersey and has golfed with Mr. Trump at least twice since he became president, according to a person who saw them.
How many times since the coronavirus outbreak happened?
I don't know, but I have a feeling they're probably in touch. People are just making bank, and they're setting up to. Like, it's 18 months until a vaccine. Once the vaccine gets made, gear up for incredibly infuriating news about the Trump administration giving one company exclusive rights to produce it and jack up the price as much as they want. Like, that's for next season. For this season, they're not going to wait for that. They need to make money now. And so they need to hype up a drug that is going to get sold even before we find out if it's effective or not. And they're going to make tons of money off of that. And along the way, really fast, along the way, the medical experts that are trying to caution people about the incredibly severe side effects of it and all of that, and trying to tamp down this public hype about it, they are being warned not to do so. So even though Dr. Anthony Fauci has been outspoken in his skepticism of using hydroxychloroquine, political reports that other career health officials behind the scenes have, quote, been warned not to publicly speak out and potentially contradict Trump, even as they've raised concerns about, quote, the risk to some Americans' heart health and other complications from taking the drug. So responsible medical professionals that are trying to get people to stop taking this and dying, or not worrying about the virus because, hey, we've got hydroxychloroquine, we're going to be fine, they're being told, no, Trump is in charge of medical reality. You will bow down to him, and you're not going to say anything in public that is going to make him look bad and get in the way of him and all the rich people he knows making a ton of money off this thing.
Yep, you're not going to mess this up for me. That's all that says. That's how our government works.
When you run government like a business, you know what you get? Investment opportunities. That's what you get.
Especially if you run like a corrupt business, it's
exactly.
even worse.
Like a Trump business. The White House press secretary is out. Long live the White House press secretary. Stephanie Grisham is returning to serve on First Lady Melania Trump's staff. Although I have to wonder, is she serving in the same way that she served as press secretary? Will Melania Trump ever see her? Because she was the press secretary that never, like, talked to the press, was never a secretary for the press. I tweeted earlier today, I don't know if you watch The Office, but press secretary has all of the actual meaning day-to-day of assistant to the regional manager. Like, it doesn't actually mean anything, but she is gone. So what do you think about that?
John, I'm more upset that you missed, or maybe it wouldn't have flowed very well, but you gave me the vibes, the Rock vibes. I know you're a Rock fan, the wrestler, the actor. Finally, Stephanie Grisham has come back to the, First Lady's office?
I had forgotten that line, but yeah.
You kind of said it. You said, finally, she's back.
Finally.
If they had this ceremony where they announce her like that, that'd be awesome. Number one. Number two, we were talking about this morning. We had the morning meeting. I want to say Doug Collins, but he's the one that's running in Georgia. Mark Meadows, who has become the new chief of staff after they booted Mulvaney out. His first thing was to come in and try and take care of Stephanie Grisham, get her out of there, bring in someone else. So I think this is a bit of that directive from him. It's kind of his first moves in his position is to make sure that happens. And I think that's all it was. I mean, as we point out, she's done nothing as far as publicly. Any statement that's come out with her name on it, I'm pretty sure she didn't write.
Yeah.
So, I mean, she was kind of there because they had no intention of having any press conferences at all, especially with her speaking to the press, who's getting more and more involved in exposing the BS that this administration continues to carry out.
It is ridiculous how much money she was able to make for doing virtually nothing, like going on cable news.
And let's keep real, she's not fired. She's going back to her other job. I mean, I'm sure it's not getting paid minimum wage.
I have a feeling. Now, she is gone, but we do obviously need to have a press secretary, and we do. Kayleigh McEnany, a campaign spokeswoman, will replace her. The latest shakeup, blah, blah, blah. So, Kayleigh McEnany is a person who started going on cable news to defend Trump no matter what in 2016, including when he was bragging about sexually assaulting women in the infamous tape. She was, you can see on Media Matters, all of her stuff, like, no, he's not saying that, he's not saying that. She was nobody. She defended Trump, lied for him, lied about his lies.
Yep.
And so now she's going to be the press secretary.
She showed up every chance she could on CNN as a contributor to talk about. As you pointed out, the main thing that stuck out for me, her, because I think it was Chris Cuomo, was appalled when she said, Trump has never lied. He goes, okay, you can still support the guy and point out that he's lied. She goes, I'm being for real. He's never lied.
Yeah.
So anytime you see a Trump supporter, especially when it comes to an official, someone who has some kind of position in some levels of the Republican Party or in government, they're auditioning. Every chance they get on Fox News, CNN, anything, when they say ridiculous things, and then we talk about how ridiculous they are, how big of a lie this is, and how they can actually show their face in public saying this stuff, all it is an audition. So we see insanity. Trump sees a candidate for a position. And you know what? Hey, the results are only proving the process. So if I have aspirations of becoming a press secretary, and I look at what Kayleigh McEnany has done, I was like, well, that's the blueprint. When it comes to this administration, just say whatever, lie, kneel down, kiss the ring, and you'll get the job. It works.
Yeah, they know it. They're either trying to get on Fox News, they're trying to sell a book, or they're trying to get a job in the administration, because loyalty is the only requirement. And, like, does CNN not know that when they're bringing these people on? When they're regularly given, like, a massive platform to people that they know will come on and lie and say things that they don't believe.
But that's I feel like it's just part of the game. I don't think CNN has a plan to allow her to audition. They're like, well, we have an idiot that's going to say anything. Let's have a fight on air. That's where it ends, because then enough people will watch it. Enough advertisers will be happy with the ratings. The ratings will be fine. And then we go through the circle again. So everyone kind of uses this as a money-making scheme in their own ways. Kayleigh McEnany is like, I'll go on CNN and look like an idiot. Doesn't matter. The Trump likes me to look like likes for people to look like idiots. That's how you get into his inner circle. It worked. CNN has a fight on air every other night. That works. Make money.
It works for money. Yes. It's infuriating.
Yeah.
It's a waste of our time. Yeah. Stop bringing on people who are liars. It's not an honest disagreement on values or policy. It's not. It's people who are saying what they know is not true, but that is good for their career to say. And that is one of the biggest issues in media right now, is the financial incentive to lie to your audience, because your audience wants you to lie to them.
Yeah, you know, actually, come to think of it, maybe it's a good audition, because she's proven that she can lie on camera for an extended period of time in the name of the president. And that's lately what the role of the press secretary is.
And I thought about putting together like this is Kayleigh McEnany, like 10 things she said. Maybe we'll do that later on. I wanted to give you one, though. This is from February. This was her saying, this president will always put America first. He will always protect American citizens. We will not see diseases like the coronavirus come here. We will not see terrorism come here. And isn't that refreshing when contrasting it with the awful presidency of President Obama? So, yeah, it's here. Well over 1/3 of 1 million Americans have it, like 12,000 Americans already documented have died from it. So will there be a moment, a second, a picosecond of reckoning where she will say, man, I could not have been more wrong. And I was saying that, like, man, it feels good that he's going to protect us. Not like Obama. Remember when Ebola killed a million Americans? Not like that. We want someone who actually protects us. Oh, wait, no, I'm totally wrong. He didn't do anything. People are dying by the thousands every single day. Ebola didn't ravage America. Like, there is some, there's a moment potentially for learning there that she has no financial incentive to experience. If yeah, she did, she'd be done. Her career would be over if she acknowledged that.
You can't acknowledge your mistakes. And, you know, and almost somebody's going to ask her, hey, so Kaylee, there's this quote where you said that there was this disaster. I'm going to say the awful presidency of Obama based off of all these things that you said he brought in terrorists. And then there's never going to be coronavirus ever going to make step foot on this country. So if we break down that statement, since you were wrong, because black and white, you were wrong. You said coronavirus. Let's read it again. We will not see diseases like the coronaviruses come here. Let's just stop there. Is it here, Kaylee? Mm-hmm. Okay, yes, it's here. If you say no, then I mean, it's the end of the conversation.
No, it's the, you know, the governors didn't do enough in China something, and China did it. And, you know, I'm hearing about a biolab in North Carolina and, like, you know, but.
Actually, that might be, you're right. That might be a thing. You say it's the governor's fault. It's China's fault. It's all these people's fault. So I was like, I thought President Trump was the all-powerful, mighty human being who can stop anything. That's what you said before. So you have to admit it's here. Now that it is here, does that mean this presidency is as awful as the presidency of Obama, since that's what you were comparing it to, since that wouldn't happen? It's happened, so doesn't that mean it's awful? Answer me the question. If it's not awful, that means it's not here. There's a problem with logic.
It's been weeks now that we know that multiple senators, including Kelly Loeffler, used the confidential information they were given a couple months ago about coronavirus to make a huge amount of money and avoid losing large amounts of money on the stock market. And there have been calls for them to be kicked out of their office, if not sent to prison, for the obvious insider trading that they engaged in. Thus far, there have been no consequences. But today, indications that there might be consequences. There might be justice? Kind of? Not really, but something. So here's what we've got. Congressman Doug Collins, the former top Republican on the House Judiciary Committee, is leading Ms. Loeffler 36% to 13% in Georgia's all-party special election. Among likely voters who identify as Republicans, Mr. Collins led Ms. Loeffler 70 to 20%, which means that she probably will not go to prison, and the guy that will potentially replace her is probably, you know, a disaster of his own, but she might lose her job at the very least, and thus access to the information that she will use to, you know, engage in future corruption.
Well, I mean,
impressed
at
all?
She'll still be able to continue to trade to the degree that she does on the stock market without anyone nagging her about it. I'm talking about how she potentially is utilizing this whole pandemic for her financial gain. So there's a natural thought that you want to celebrate this horrible person potentially losing. We'll see where it goes.
We'll see.
The poll's showing her getting trounced right now. But Doug Collins.
Yeah? You think he might be just as bad?
I mean, maybe for different reasons. I don't know what his portfolio is like. I'm not sure what his insider trading skills are. Again, I'm not accusing you of doing it, just looks that way. I'm not sure his degree of being involved in the stock market in times like this, but I do know he was one of the loudest, boisterous, annoying voices during every issue that Trump had that he was exposed for as illegal activity, being one of the biggest offenders and kneelers to the president. So this is also the same guy that once he decided to make this run in the Senate, the Republican Party, the state Republican Party there had wanted nothing to do with him making this move. They got really upset. It's one of the few times you'll see Republicans openly discourage and almost kind of beat down one of their own and saying, how dare you do this right now? Hey, stay right there. This is going to be a problem. What if you run up here and this happens? They had an issue with his move. And maybe he had some inside information about her inside information.
Yeah.
And he knew this was going to fall apart for her and he wanted to take advantage. But they were not on board. I wonder how much they've switched now.
Yeah, I don't know. And look, we're going to end up, God, like if he gets the seat, that's going to be terrible too. But I don't know, at least temporarily, like I want to see something like justice, because We're finding out more and more. I'm going to give you details on another individual in just a second, but there has to be some kind of consequences for this. And it has been infuriating to me over the past few weeks that so few in the media have stayed on this story. Like that we were just like, that does seem like that's wrong. Okay, so what else is going on? Man, that Tiger King, that's something. Yeah, there's a lot going on. I totally get it. But this is horrendous. And as I tweeted earlier, like maybe this is going too far. I don't know. But if you sell off stock knowing that the stock market is going to collapse to avoid losing money, that is one thing. When you buy up stock in companies that will only do well if coronavirus devastates America, then think about the incentives that that provides for you. When you go to vote or to lead on legislation or to slow roll legislation or just stay quiet about what could be done, you have a financial incentive against the interest of the American people and the continuation of their lives. And I know what you'll say. Well, obviously, they're not going to do something that will kill people just to make some money. Okay, first of all, I don't think that's obvious. But do you really want to be in a position where we have to hope that she puts our medical interests ahead of her financial interests? Do you really want to be in that position? I don't know her. She's been in that position for a couple of months. Do you really trust her to make the right call based on what you know about her stock activity? I damn sure don't.
And what is it about her as a politician that has you trust her and her potential in changing your health? I mean, look, when Obamacare was rolled out, there was a lot of people who were against it. They said, I can't trust a guy to get between me and my doctor, death panels, all the things they were pushing. So for some reason, why don't those things apply to another person that's in public office that doesn't know you and has proven they don't care about you or care about policies that will help you? It's, again, they prove themselves, but we just refuse to listen at times. And maybe people are starting to listen with her situation because look what's happening.
And look, she's obviously not the only one. So I want to update you on another individual that was potentially engaging in these sorts of activities. Senator David Perdue of Georgia bought stock in DuPont, a chemical company that produces personal protective equipment, on the same day the Senate received a classified briefing on the spread of the novel coronavirus, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Perdue's disclosure form lists 112 transactions, 82 of which were made on March 3rd alone. 76 were stock purchases of as much as $1.8 million. The report also documents 34 stock sales worth as much as $825K. Wow. The Journal Constitution reported that Purdue's portfolio activity from March onward was three times busier than it was in the last 13-month period before the coronavirus hit the U.S. So Shore acted fast and acted a lot, far more than in literally more than a year beforehand. But according to spokeswoman for Perdue, Sherry Gillian, she said that since coming to the U.S. Senate in 2015, Senator Perdue has always had an outside advisor managing his personal finances, and he's not involved in day-to-day decisions. For the past 5 years, the senator has fully complied with federal law and all Senate ethics requirements. I don't doubt those last two parts, because the law is set up in a way to allow them to get away with all sorts of things, and there are virtually no ethics requirements whatsoever. So that's a funny little trick you've got there. But the idea that he left a meeting and went and immediately bought shares in a company that theoretically will do very well as a result of what our government knew but wasn't saying about coronavirus. Oh yeah, I'm sure an outside advisor just happened to come to the same conclusion that the senator did based on confidential information that he had just gotten. For all we know, he rushed into the hallway, put Prudential or whatever on his phone. I don't know what app he uses, and bought the stock right then. That is some coincidence.
Yeah, and then you can say within the law, the lawyer speak always is highlighted or gets exposed in these situations. Hey, he did everything he did within the law during this time period that they would allow him to. Yeah, and there's a lot of allowances within the law to allow people to do things like this and get away with it. Only certain people, by the way. Yep. Not everyone. So, okay, we talked before about how Loeffler had her issues, and maybe we should just not even allow if you're elected official to even trade, so you don't even have the look of impropriety, huh? How about that? Okay, so let's take a step further. Okay, you have no idea what your outside blind financial advisor who's making the moves with $825,000 in one small piece of your money is doing. Okay, it's okay. So since you're separated from them and you're an elected official and you work for us, we get to ask your financial advisor, what was the reasoning then? Show us the reasons why you did what you did at the time. Yeah. And yeah, that seems like it's violating his personal information, right? You don't get that personal information anymore, because it looks like you're defrauding the American people to profit off of sicknesses and deaths and information that you could have given to everyone else to save more lives. So yes, we are privy to that information now. If you're saying you have nothing to do with it, what are the reasons that you had this curious? You hit home runs every time, mm-hmm. just blindly. This is a really good financial advisor. He should work for everybody, huh?
He should. He should. And look, so obviously I don't think they should be allowed to have stock. I think that they should be banned from making money in all sorts of different ways. Lifetime ban on lobbying. They shouldn't be able to do the high dollar speeches and all that. If they're going to be servants of us, let them be actual servants. Okay, they shouldn't be making huge amounts of money. But someone pointed out, we said, you know, that like you can't bet on, you know, an athletic event that you're part of if you're a professional.
Yeah.
Someone pointed out you can't join contests and raffles that are sponsored or hosted by your own company in a lot of cases, but you can buy stocks that'll be affected by your actions as a politician. And why is it, by the way, that we haven't found one senator who left these meetings and went and invested in, you know, Froyo and escape rooms? You know,
yep.
No one made bad financial decisions coming out of those meetings. Isn't that weird that we haven't found one? Maybe they're just shy.
No one left and then went and put a bunch of money into Ford.
Yeah, or Banana Republic. Everyone Ford. Came out, like you said, like just batting, you know, 500, I don't know.
Batting 1,000.
Bet 1,000, I guess. Okay, I didn't want to go too far.
500 is pretty good, too. But no,
it is.
They're batting an incredible rate right now.
I hear 300 is good. I hear it's good. Jeter, you know? Anyway, sports on the damage report. Where's Ricky Strum? Let's get him in here. A Louisville area doctor is now facing charges for becoming so infuriated by the fact that a group of young people were not engaged in proper social distancing routines that he began to strangle her. Okay, this is, warning. This is difficult footage to watch, but here it is.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah, we're leaving. Please, let's not cuss at each other. No, I'm not calling you anything, sir. Just don't talk to us with
this.
So, you see there, you know, it looks like there's a few people and he engages, you know, verbally with a few. It appears from what I've seen in the video that he has singled out the one black girl in the group to take to the ground and begin strangling.
It sounded like it seemed like you started this, or it's because of you. I couldn't tell when he decided to attack fully on this young woman. I don't know where this is going. I hope it's the fullest extent of assault charges are put against this guy, because he's worried about what is it again? Social distancing. Mm-hmm. So what does strangulation require you to do?
Violate social distancing pretty severely, usually.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not just maybe some, you know, air, they say like sneezing and air matter and spittle is part of the transmission process. But let's just go ahead and touch someone, strangle them, and maybe that'll prove your point. No, man, this guy needs to be put under the jail. He's one of the worst people out there. So this is how you're looking to get things done now. Mm-hmm. Hey, how about you walk away? And I've seen plenty of people. I've been out. I had a couple runs last week or 2 weeks ago now. Shit, I miss a whole week. So the thing is, what happens is you see people out without masks on. You see people close to each other. I've seen a few gatherings. And you know what I do when I see it? I'm like,
yeah.
Wish they'd do better. And
then
what I do is I go that way.
Yeah. So you don't literally touch them, get in their face.
Yeah. We see people do things we don't agree with all the time. You know what you do? You go, oh. Stay safe.
Yeah.
Moving. What does that have to do with you?
Jesus. Yeah. So the suspect has been identified as a physician for Southern Indiana Anesthesia Consultants in nearby New Albany, Indiana. He was placed on administrative leave while the incident was investigated. A police report shows the 18-year-old victim suffered minor injuries when the man choked her and impeded her breathing, and he could face a felony charge of first-degree strangulation. I mean, He there's a camera in his face. Two cameras. He knows he's being filmed, and he got on the ground over a girl and began to strangle her, which is what you do when you are attempting to kill a person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that he wanted to kill her, was trying to kill her, but that's what you do when you try to kill a person. And so bizarre that he's like sparring back and forth with a couple of girls who are standing, and they're swearing at each other. The girl's on the ground. He goes over to her to try to strangle her. And, like, obviously, there's racism concerns there, clearly.
That by himself is what it was. People just like that to satisfy their superiority, to satisfy their anger. And he's like, let me go for the person that I hate the most. Let's go for the person I think is the most vulnerable. She's already on the ground. I can just jump on her because I'm a weak human being. And he also attacked a group of young women that he assumes can't fight back enough to dismantle him. There's many words that I want to say about him, what should have happened if there was other people there that could take care of him physically. So that all that is maybe it's subconscious in his head, but it's definitely seen as an opportunity to fulfill some kind of a desire he wanted to attack people based off of something he disagreed with. You can disagree with it. Nobody's saying that you're wrong about disagreeing with it. Disagree with it in your head and walk away.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I always feel bad, like, doing stories like this, especially now. You know, we want to focus, and we do focus sometimes on the people who are helping and making things better. Mm-hmm. But we also can't ignore that there are people that at a time when people are pulling together and they're being better versions of themselves, some people are worse versions of themselves or normal. Maybe he's that terrible all the time. But that's a doctor. That's someone who literally, thanks to the anesthesia, has the power of whether people live through medical procedures. Mm-hmm. And this is a person who apparently has been going through their day waiting to strangle someone, waiting to be given an excuse to do that. Because there's every physical reason in the world to just walk away from that group.
Yeah.
And that's what's angering you, is the fact that they're too close. And yet you get on top of them and you begin strangling.
We'll put it in the worst case scenario. You walked by and you said, hey, young ladies, hey, you guys should probably not be collected together. Maybe remember practice social distancing. And maybe they'll scream back and throw a middle finger at you and say, F you, old man. And if that happens, you know what you do? You go, kids these days. Walk away.
And then walk away. Yes.
I don't care if they were the initiators of any kind of anger or any kind of, hey, get out of here, or rudeness. Mm-hmm. I don't care.
And by the way, you can't be shocked by it. When you're like a 50 or 60-year-old person and you go into a park and you happen across a group of teenagers, the end result is you're going to be frustrated, annoyed, or infuriated by their behavior. That's just what always happens, even not in a pandemic. That's what groups of teenagers in parks do. They infuriate you. Anyway, guy deserves the charges that he hopefully will get. But it's America, so who knows? I am very excited to be joined once again on the channel by a candidate running for Congress in New York's 10th District, Jonathan Herzog. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me again. Good to see you, John.
Good to see you. Good to see anyone, honestly. Anyone healthy. So the last time we spoke was back in August of last year. It's been a bit. It's it's possible some people in the audience might not be familiar with your candidacy. Can you tell us a little bit about what brought you into politics?
Absolutely. Well, I'm Jonathan Herzog. I'm running for Congress in New York's 10th District, which is the west side of Manhattan and South Brooklyn. It covers the world's financial capital, but one in six folks live below the federal poverty line and can't meet their basic needs. It's in many ways the ground zero, the epicenter, the microcosm for our winner-take-all economy, where on opposite sides of the street, you have luxury housing developments, and on the other side, you have squalor and New York City public housing. And I came to run for Congress through my work on Andrew Yang's campaign, where I left and joined his campaign as the sixth hire to build and kick off the Iowa operation and help turn Andrew into the internet candidate and help bring universal basic income to the fore and to the mainstream of the national conversation.
Awesome. And we're certainly going to be talking about UBI and how it's one of the most prominent policies being talked about right now a little bit later on. So he obviously developed into this superstar. Now you're running for Congress against Jerry Nadler, who's a pretty well-known incumbent, by the way. He's held the seat for 7 years now. So tell me a little bit about the decision to challenge him. In what ways do you think that Jerry Nadler isn't sort of living up to what he should in that position?
Yeah, well, he's held the seat for about 30 years, as it was gerrymandered in various ways. But really, it has nothing to do with him. It has nothing to do with our establishment legacy politicians and institutions and systems that are just catching up to the tectonic shifts in our economy and technology and in the pandemic today. It has to do with our vision. And really, I have to say, you know, thank you. And so such incredible inspiration to the work that the Bernie movement and Justice Democrats and Brand New Congress and this entire wave of a new generation of leadership that is fighting unabashedly for new progressive reform. And so was truly inspired by that to be a part of a wave of freedom Democrats running on the Yang-Yang agenda, beginning with this universal basic income, a new floor, a new right of citizenship below which no one can or should fall in the wealthiest country in the history of the world.
Do you think that the experience of the past few years, I mean, you referenced Bernie Sanders there, do you think that the issues that Bernie Sanders and other, you know, related politicians or ideologically similar that they've raised, do you think that that is increasing the percentage of the population that is willing to question some of these long-term incumbents and not just assume that if this has been my representative, this should be my representative for the next, you know, 1 to 3 decades?
I think certainly it has fundamentally changed the dynamic of who can run, of who we think can run, and the amount of money you need to win. And certainly we need to move towards public financing of elections and fundamental campaign finance reform, but it really has upended some of our basic assumptions that we have to accept multi-decade incumbents who've never faced serious primary challengers in their entire careers. So it's thanks to that leadership and that wave of new young leaders that we've challenged the basic assumptions of what it means to represent our communities.
Well, you know, so you mentioned that there's, you know, we're rethinking for some of these candidates, rethinking how to raise money and hopefully raising, again, the percentage of the population that is at least questioning where a politician's money comes from. But while we're talking right now, obviously, most of the country is under lockdown. How is that influencing both the way that you're campaigning, but also the way that you're raising funds to continue this this campaign?
Yeah. And so the scope and scale of this crisis is really unprecedented. You know, we're talking about 10 million filing for unemployment and projections of 30% of the country facing unemployment. So we haven't even fully processed the scale and scope and shock and just sheer travesty and loss of life that we'll be going through. But in the context of the campaign, tragically or ironically, this is the Yang-Yang strong suit in that brought these ideas to the fore in the absence of mainstream media and institutional support and a lot of gatekeepers and barriers to entry. So in many ways, the digital online organizing, being a group of digital natives and having a model of distributed organizing and work is kind of at the core of our being and at the core of the movement itself.
And, you know, I'm also curious, this is something I've been talking about with a few primary challengers recently. So as you point out, I mean, you come from the section of the party that is probably most primed to do this sort of digital campaigning. But do you feel that being in this extended crisis, do you worry at all that that might make it more difficult in an unequal fashion, that incumbents who are going to be able to rely a little bit on their name recognition, institutional support, you know, decades in some cases of fundraising, that they might have an exaggerated advantage in a time where some of the more traditional canvassing opportunities, those sorts of things, are pretty severely constrained into the near future?
Certainly, power and legacy systems of power never give way on their own. And we see this really clearly in the recent Supreme Court ruling, where at every single chance that institutions and systems of power have, they will defend that power and usurp and suppress the vote and the democratic process. And we're seeing that with a constant evolution of what voting looks like, even in the first place. So certainly that's the case, but that's the backdrop we're working with. And history has shown us that, you know, it'll take a movement, but we can certainly make meaningful, significant dents and put up some big wins on the board.
So, Jonathan, you've talked about your time with Andrew Yang, and obviously he was very important in terms of debate after debate raising UBI as a policy. Now you know, as the government is trying to respond to coronavirus, like that was the answer that was presented, at least in the front. In the back, they were giving a lot of money to corporations and stuff like that. But for helping people, it was effectively at least short-term UBI. Do you feel that had Andrew Yang decided to go on vacation instead of running for president, you know, 2 years ago, would that have happened? Was he the linchpin in making UBI part of this response?
Well, certainly there's this saying and empirical reality that what seems politically impossible can only become inevitable in the times of crisis, where it's the ideas that are in the fore that are percolating to the surface that are even considered to be on the table in a time of crisis, in a time of depression and war, or in this case, pandemic. And so against all odds, really, it just illustrates and vindicates fighting for principled ideas and beliefs and maintaining that conviction. Because to your point, who would have thought that from Mitt Romney to Justin Amash to Rashida to AOC to members of the Trump administration, all across the aisle in some form of another or another, folks would support some version of direct cash transfers to Americans.
And so right now we had already passed, as of when we're recording this, you know, a little bit more money than even the monthly payment that Andrew Yang had been advocating for, but for a very limited time. Now, politicians like Bernie Sanders are saying, no, it needs to be $2,000 and it does need to go forward until, you know, we don't know exactly when. Do you feel like that is the right path, that the $1,000 is not necessarily intended to grapple with an economic catastrophe of this sort? Should it be something that we are looking to expand out, you know, for the next 6 months, the next year? What form of UBI would you advocate for if you were holding the position today?
Yeah, certainly the proposals that suggest $1,000 as a floor for all adults and around $500 for all children, or $2,000 on a monthly basis for the duration of the crisis, these are steps in the right direction. And this is not enough as a stopgap. Certainly even $1,200 as a one-time payment on its own is not enough. And we will need to have multiple ways of stimulus that don't just put a fraction of the entire bill, the entire bailout, directly into people's hands. But what we'll see is that once folks start to get these checks, we will start to question it at a fundamental level. Well, where did this $2 trillion come from? Mm-hmm. How is it possible that actually the government can send and bail out its own people above multinational firms? And once we start questioning that fundamental possibility, it opens the gates to, as you said, greater and greater investment in people directly.
So, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at is your gut feeling. Obviously, you worked with one of the men who did the most individually to raise. Obviously, UBI goes back a long way. People have been advocating it for a long time. But Andrew Yang was fundamental in getting it to be a household name, sort of like AOC with the Green New Deal. These are not necessarily new ideas, but they do need a leader, a spokesperson. Do you feel like you can't put the genie back in the bottle, that once people realize that this is possible and they start to see some of the positive benefits of it, that even once, you know, we're not thinking about coronavirus on a daily basis, that you will see more politicians pushing forward as sort of the de facto one component of the social safety net?
I think it is definitely harder to put the genie back in the bottle. But the one thing that we've seen is that there is nothing inevitable. There's no teleology about this. And the last time we saw unemployment projections hit 30, 32% was around the 1930s. In Germany. And there is no teleology, nothing natural about history and the course of events. There are ideas, there are people, and there are people who act upon those ideas. So I agree with you that it makes it much more likely. It makes the barrier for political courage a lot lower, but we need to act upon it and defend it and fight on all fronts at all times.
You know, one other aspect of, you know, Andrew Yang's platform and what he talked about a lot was automation. And I'm curious that now we're in a situation where people are being forced to work from home, if that's even possible. Many people are losing their jobs. There's any number of different essential workers that are at an incredible amount of risk on a daily basis. Some of them would be, I think, very hard to replace, but I'm sure efforts are underway to replace those, you know, who are working in, you know, like supermarkets, food delivery, some things like that. And even once we get past coronavirus, there will be other pandemics potentially. Are you worried that this could help to accelerate that trend towards automation that you know people who are ideologically affiliated with you have been warning about?
That's unfortunately exactly right. And by the data, which is firms are accelerating, firms are investing at an even faster pace, not just in furloughs and in layoffs, but in automating systems and processes and entire sectors. And so unfortunately, COVID-19 and this pandemic is only accelerating the underlying trends and underlying realities of an economy and a system that's pushing more and more and more people aside.
And Jonathan, where can people find out more about your platform, about your candidacy?
Absolutely. So it's on Herzog2020.com, or if you're on social media, JonathanHerzog5 on Twitter, on Instagram, and Facebook, and all of the above.
Awesome, Jonathan. Well, thank you once again for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.